You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Indeed Sponsored Jobs. Maybe you're looking to recruit a big new signing for your organisation. Whatever business you're in, Indeed Sponsored Jobs can help you fill vacancies with the best possible candidates. Indeed Sponsored Jobs will help your job ad stand out from the crowd, which will boost the quality of the candidates who apply and help you to sift through those applications to draw up the best possible shortlist and ultimately hire the right person for your team. It makes a big difference too, because according to Indeed's data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 90% more likely to report a quality hire than non-sponsored jobs. That's because you reach a bigger pool of quality candidates and the sponsored job will stand out from the crowd. Join the 1.6 million companies that use sponsored jobs with Indeed. You'll spend more time interviewing candidates who tick all of your boxes. There's less stress, less time spent on the recruitment process, and better results now with Indeed sponsored jobs. And because you listen to the Cycling Podcast, you can get a £100 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves. Go to indeed.com/cycle. That's indeed.com/cycle. Support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on the Cycling Podcast. Indeed.com/cycle. Terms and conditions apply. If you're hiring, do it the right way with Indeed. Now it's on with the show.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and welcoming you for the first time officially in springtime 2026. So after a weekend whose defining images were arguably Paul Sexas casually sipping from a bidon while dismembering the rest of the field at the Fourne Ardèche Classic on Saturday, and Matthew Brennan politely declining a glug of Belgian Trappist beer to celebrate his victory in Brussels Kuurne on Sunday. My name's Daniel Freiber. I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we will attempt to drink in and swallow down everything that occurred in the world of professional cycling on Saturday and Sunday, including the two remarkable exhibitions of precocity I've already mentioned. Joining me to do that on this Monday morning, his glass already charged, is Lionel Burney.
Hello, Daniel.
And also in position, sober as a judge, I hope. It's not yet lunchtime, but ready to imbibe the learnings of this first swig of classics action. It's Rob Hatch.
Yes, Daniel. It is a bank holiday here where I am, so I'm resisting for the moment. I'm just on the coffee.
So you'll be on the lash later on. Is that what you say?
Maybe.
This afternoon?
Maybe.
No need. Certainly no need to have any to really dive into the issue of Matthew Brennan not drinking his Trappist beer on the podium in Kuurne. But it did remind me, this happened a couple of years ago, didn't it? There was a little bit more sort of debate about someone politely declining Belgian beer on the podium of a classic a couple of years ago.
I think that was Amstel, wasn't it? Although this weekend that I didn't realize.
Oh, Pidcock.
That was
Pidcock
it.
Pidcock at Amstel. Yeah.
But I think what we've had this weekend was, I think he's a, is he a celiac, Matthew Brennan? I think I might have read this morning.
I thought I lip-read him saying to, whether it was Mozzato or Trentin, I think, on the podium of Kuurne yesterday, I don't drink. But I don't know about whether he's a celiac. That might be true.
I mean, Tom Pidcock turning down Amstel is just a matter of taste,
yes,
isn't it? But maybe they should offer a 0% alternative. The Affligem Zero is very good, for example. And the Leffe Zero is not bad either. So, you know, there's alternatives now. They don't have to just, you know, if you could have your, what is it, gallon glass of Quaremont Zero after Gent-Wevelgem in a few weeks' time.
International listeners might have concluded, having listened to us and having watched those two respective races, Amstel Gold a couple of years ago and Kuurne Brussels Kuurne, the British people don't drink. I don't know. Maybe, Lionel, can you confirm or deny?
Well, I think it's very individual, isn't it?
Although I'm in Spain, where I think the most common trait that people associate with British people is alcohol, unfortunately. I could hear someone laughing just down the street when you said that.
Well, Rob, I heard on your commentary you did make reference to Richard Plugger, actually, didn't you? When Richard Plugger, of course, being the manager of Visma Leasebike, who infamously, a few years ago got himself involved in a little bit of a minor storming, it was a teacup then, about, it was the French riders, it was FDG riders, wasn't it? at the Tour de France. Oh, not riders, staff members at the Tour de France. Anyway, this is a huge digression, huge digression. We are, of course, going to be talking a lot about what happened in Belgium over the weekend, not just Kuna Brussels Kuna, but also Omloop on Saturday. Pretty decent, as I said, swig of classics action start things off in opening weekend, but also that, well, remarkable performance. Another remarkable performance, more hype around Paul Sexas. We are vastly becoming the English-speaking sex cast, the French sex cast. We discussed that last week in last week's episode, the RMC podcast, which devotes inordinate amounts of time to him and his exploits every week. That has not yet been released. That's not yet dropped on this Monday morning. So
I think we need to have a sort of red card ready for anyone who says, you know, refers to this as the joy of sex, because it's...
Well, there are endless possibilities with this surname, aren't there? Particularly if you're choosing a sort of an Instagram post, sound effects, soundtrack for an Instagram post. Endless possibilities, sexy time, you know.
Daniel's already got a list for the 25 victories he's going to bring on this year.
I think I prefer success rather than the sex-related puns. I think maybe that should be our in-house style guide for the coming year, because we are going to run out of superlatives for him the way things are going, aren't we? But we'll talk about that a bit later on. Before that, it's openings weekend, and we've got to hear from our very good friend, haven't we, Daniel?
We have. We will do that, I believe, at the start of the next parts. A short detour, as always, now in time-honored fashion to Corvitz Corner.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode of the Cycling Podcast is brought to you by BICMO Cycle Insurance, because let's face it, things happen. Whether it's a crash landing, the heartbreak of a stolen bike, or the ultimate facepalm moment of reversing over your prized aero wheel, BICMO has you covered. Flexible policies that you can cancel anytime, 50% off extra bikes in your household, protection for your kit, race entries, and even damage while travelling to your next epic ride. They've thought of it all. And here's the thing, BICMO isn't some faceless insurance company. They're all bike riders too, with a shared mission to protect the world's riders and the places we ride. So when you insure with them, you're not just getting great coverage, you're joining a community that gets what it means to love cycling. So whether you're smashing sprints, grinding climbs, or just enjoying a Sunday spin, ride safe. BICMO's got your back. Protect your ride before it's too late. Head to BICMO.com to get covered. That's BICMO.com. Flexible policies. Cancel any time. Terms apply. Check your policy docs.
Pay attention, Freebie. I hope you enjoyed the typical opening weekend that showcased everything cycling in Vlaanderen has to offer. The Belgian media tend to jump to conclusions after Kuurne, but it's far too early for that. After all, it will be at least 4 weeks before we get to the cobbled monuments, classics, and then Podjakar, and hopefully Pedersen and Van Aert will be there too. They are heavyweights, competing in the same league as Mathieu van der Poel. With van der Poel and Matthew Brennan, we had two debutants as winners. The 8-time cyclocross world champion achieved something in Omloop Nieuwsblad, something Tom Boonen never managed in his entire career. His climb up the Molenberg was pure art. Like a balancing artist, he miraculously avoided a falling Rick Plummers and then delivered the display of power. I suspect the opposition was happy that Mathieu van der Poel decided to go on training camp on Saturday Eve instead of riding Kuurne-Brussel-Kuurne. Otherwise, we may not have seen the traditional sprint on the Brugse Steenweg, which Matthew Brennan won with striking ease. The prize for regularity goes to Florian Vermeers. The world champion on gravel took on Van der Poel on Saturday and tried in vain to avoid the sprint on Sunday. That's good news for Podjakar. But there was also some bad news, as Tim Wellens is out of the spring season with a broken collarbone. The Belgian champion is one of many who remained on the battlefield. Although Stefan Koen with a broken femur is the most serious victim. The moral of the story is simple. Mathieu van der Poel is on track to set a double record on April 4th. A fourth victory in the Ronde van Vlaanderen and the first rider ever to win both the Omloop and the Ronde in the same year.
Well, chaps, almost a sermon there delivered by the high priest of Belgian classics, Hugo Corvitz. Of course, long-serving member of the Het Nieuwsblad editorial staff. Many decades, many editions of Omloop Hugo has covered. And, he summed up the events of the weekend there. Mathieu van der Poel winning Omloop. We are going to concentrate first on that. And that was on Saturday. Of course, last week we heard Hugo. I thought he was just sort of expressing doubts, misgivings about whether Van der Poel would be able to show up and win his first race of the season on Saturday. But he sort of contradicted Hugo anyway by doing it with aplomb, there was a sort of a routineness about the way he went about it. He sort of just picked that first classic off. Of course, his first appearance in Omloop, as Hugo said, he's aiming to become the first man to break the curse, the Omloop Flanders curse, chaps. And, where should we start with this?
Well, it was a race decided by one moment, really, wasn't it? The slip on the bottom section of the Molenberg. It was the Tudor rider, Rick Plumers, who was at the front of the group. The brake was still up the road, wasn't it? But it was that little slip. It's a tricky climb, the Molenberg. I mean, there's humps and hollows, and it goes over a sort of humpback bridge, and the surface itself is sort of domed as well, a bit of a crown. And the roads were greasy and wet, probably the worst kind of wet. They weren't fully wet, and they weren't really drying. They were just slick and greasy. Maybe, I mean, speculating here, but Plumers, maybe his tyre pressure was a bit too high. But he was trying to ride on the crown, coming round that corner, and he slipped. And that was the moment that really decided the race, because Florian Vermeersch was just ahead of him. And Mathieu van der Poel, I mean, he had to use all of his cyclocross skills to avoid running over Plumers, who was on the ground, and he got past. And really, that was the moment that decided the race, because they were away at that point. Tim van Dijker of Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe got up to them, and more or less that was it. They rode across to the remains of that breakaway, and then the three arrivals dropped the three original members, and away they went. And it was kind of a paint-by-numbers victory for van der Poel, wasn't it? There wasn't an awful lot of jeopardy from that point on, really. And you do wonder what would have happened, how would it have played out if that crash hadn't happened, because it was shaping up to be a bit of a head-to-head between van der Poel's team, Alpecin, Premier Tech, had to think about that for a moment there, and UAE team Emirates, because they had numbers at the front. Tim Wellens was very well placed all day until that crucial event. And it just shows, doesn't it, the importance. It's the oldest cliche in the book. Positioning going into those climbs is so, so important. And sometimes it can be really decisive. That is why it's so important to just be at the front and avoid any issues.
I'm going to controversially suggest that it wouldn't have changed. It didn't change that much.
I don't think it would have changed that much in terms of the overall result, but it just made the unfolding of the race really quite straightforward, quite formulaic, didn't it? Because there was enough cooperation between Vermeersch, certainly, and van der Poel. Van Dijk was probably a little bit happy to be there, perhaps. But maybe it was the case that van der Poel was planning to make that move on the Molenberg anyway. It was in range, wasn't it? 45 kilometres to go. I suppose the surprise was there wasn't anyone able to sort of react. It was kind of away before anybody else was able to realise what was happening. And probably there were riders who would have had their eyes on van der Poel a bit further up the climb, who were probably picking their way past the crash and the riders that had all been caused to slow down. So you're right. I thought before the race, van der Poel, he was lining up for one reason only. There was no reason for him to start the season at Omloop unless he was really targeting a victory there to tick it off his list of classics. I mean, I made a list of the 12 World Tour one-day races in the spring from Omloop to Liège, and he's won now 8 of them. The only ones missing are the Tour of Bruges, which I think it's debatable whether that should even be a World Tour race, really. Gent-Wevelgem, which he's riding a bit later on this spring, apparently. Flesh Wallonne, which he's unlikely to win, and Liège-Bastogne-Liège, where he's at least finished on the podium. I mean, it just felt like he was ticking off.
The Tour of Bruges.
The Tour of Bruges is a new name for the classic De Panne Brugge.
Wow.
One-day race. Yeah, well, exactly. It's been excitingly rebranded by
Mickey Ryan.
Wim, the marketing man over there in Flanders. But no, I mean, you're right, Daniel. I don't think anyone would have beaten Van der Poel unless Van der Poel had suffered the sort of mishap that befell Plumers.
Mm.
Being at the front is so important, and I think we saw the effect of the chaos going into the Molenberg there, of what it costs to be at the front. That road, that straight run, I think I said this on commentary, is one of the most important parts of the whole race. Because of that sharp left turn, you go over that bridge you've just described, it goes narrow, the cobbles aren't great. And Daniel, you're saying that it probably didn't change the result so much. It might not have done. The one thing that did there by going there and being at the front there was maybe the reduce the sort of possibility of something happening a bit further up the line, being caught out on one of those approaches to the next climbs, whether it be down the fast road to the Beerendries, into the Westen and up through Heerasbergen, where perhaps he would have gone anyway. I can't imagine him wanting to leave it to the Bosberg. And you sort of can make your own luck in the classics to a certain extent, can't you, by making sure that your teammates help you be at the front. And with Van der Poel, yes, he had to use his skills to get beyond poor Rick Plumers, who, by the way, ended the day at the dentist. He got a couple of new gnashes by the end of a Saturday night, so a good bit of quick dental work to sort him out, and he was relatively okay after that. But those skills that were shown, of course, thankfully, that he was in that sort of second, third row position, he could get round. And as you guys were saying, I think a lot of people who perhaps wanted to contend with him would have contended with him to a certain extent, then they were just caught behind that crash. But I do agree with what you said, Daniel, and I think I felt this on commentary as well, although our job behind the microphone is to keep the suspense going and keep the excitement going. It did feel a little inevitable once he went then.
And we always talk about all the imponderables in the classics and how luck can play its part as well, and how crashes can play their part. And, well, I'll give a list later of some of the crashes that occurred over the weekend and some of the riders whose sort of spring campaign has been compromised. But the great virtue of Van der Poel, as well as his physical ability, is, of course, his ability to avoid all of that, avoid the crashes, partly with skill. His positioning has improved, evolved a lot over the years, hasn't it? Because that was, we thought a weakness in the first few years that he rode the classics. And it just makes, I mean, there's a sort of domino effect, a kind of butterfly effect as well, of those crashes when they befall other riders. It makes riders more vulnerable to getting ill or to sort of losing their form and having to build back up and so on and so forth. And Van der Poel just seems to sail through and sail across and sail round all of that, and that makes him even more formidable, doesn't it? Because, you know, it may be that, well, Tim Wellens probably won't come back into the classics, but there are riders who will have crashed. I mean, to be honest, it happened with Brennan on Saturday, and he came back and won Kerner on Sunday. But so many riders over the next month will be dealing with little niggles, little problems that have occurred because of crashes. And as I say, Van der Poel, he avoids all of that, and he gives himself a further advantage by doing that.
If you think back to when he won Amstel Gold, his first massive race win, where he'd been pretty much out of contention going into the finale, and then he used all of that skill and all of the power that he's got to manoeuvre his way really from back to front. And I think, Daniel, you said at the time it was almost like PlayStation cycling, you know, two clicks to the right, one to the left, two up, and, you know, he picked his way through. Rob, you made the point about the cyclocross season and a lot of the races where he started further down the grid, he wasn't at the front, so he had to be patient, he had to pick his moments to move through. And in Omloop on Saturday, there were enough warning signs, weren't there? There were a lot of crashes. We saw big name riders in the wrong position for various reasons. I mean, Tom Pidcock was really out of position as they approached the Lieberg loop for the second time. Not quite sure what caused that.
He was struggling with the cold, right. Apparently.
Well, which is pretty unfortunate when your main team sponsor, its main USP, is its supposed ability to keep your body temperature at 36.5 degrees at all times, in all conditions.
Oh, dear. And there was also the kind of the wind blowing, wasn't there, before the Eckenberg, which started to split things up. I mean, it had everyone in a long line. There were some crashes. UAE lost a couple of riders. Heregots and Rui Oliveira went down in the same crash. We saw Manier, the Soudal's hope for us, if it came down to a sprint finish. He had a bike change. He was briefly considering taking one of the neutral bikes, but then thought better of it when he saw his team car and was able to take one of the specialised. So there were lots of little warning signs of, you know, the chaos to come. And then, of course, we saw quite a handful of sprinters getting dropped in the, as the pace increased heading to the Molenberg. So kind of all of the cards were falling in Van der Poel's, direction anyway. And then his positioning was first class, his bike handling was first class, and his strength and power just, you know, I mean, you could really have, it was a formality really from sort of 35 kilometres to go. And as much as I talked about the potential for Ten Bosserstraat changing the finale a little bit in last week's episode, I mean, it wasn't a factor at all, was it? It was just a case of which moment will Van der Poel choose to go away. And as it was, he just stretched away from them on the Muir, didn't he? As they went through Hellersbergen and then up, you know, the gap was open before they reached a chapel or could see the chapel. And then he was away. And then it was kind of, it was that kind of, as I said earlier, sort of paint by numbers finish for him. No one was going to catch from that point. The only glimmer, really, was that Visma Lisebike did at least have some numbers in that group behind. But the sting went out of Vennie Chase there when there was another crash that Matt Brennan went down in. Arnaud Delis went down as well. So that kind of hampered the Lotto Antimarché efforts in the chase. And, formulaic in the end. And another one ticked off the list for Van der Poel. I mean, it was a slightly Affligem Zero edition of Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, I would suggest, but I like Affligem Zero, so I was happy.
Lionel, you mentioned that phase before the Molenberg when a few sprinters, a few sort of contenders came a cropper. That was also a key point in the race because it was at that point that I think Jasper Philipsen had a puncture. And we talked last week, and I think Hugo talked as well, about how Alpecin were covered. They had both a sprint option in Philipsen. They also had Caden Gross riding really well, and also Van der Poel. But it was probably key for them at that point as well that there was no hesitation, there was no dilly-dallying to sort of wait for Philipsen and maybe put whatever Van der Poel was planning on the back burner. They were very decisive at that point, which is kind of characteristic of how they've approached the classics over the last few years. And it also helps when you have a rider like Van der Poel who seems to be so lucid in those situations.
And this is what they live for, isn't it? This is where they come alive. I think the same pattern in the last few years where we get this racing in January and February, and you know, if we talk about UAE starting well, other teams getting a load of wins. Alpecin Premier Tech, again, Lionel, I'm having to keep stopping myself to stop saying the old sponsor's name as well. I think that might have slipped out in commentary at the weekend. They didn't really do anything the last few years, but then the classics start, then they turn up, then they perform, and it's just what they do. They aren't the biggest budget team, but they've got one of the best riders in the world and a few others to back him up. And for the first time, they, as well as Mathieu van der Poel, actually managed to fill a bit of a hole in their team, Palmer, as Alpecin Premier Tech had never won the Omloop, but they have now.
Just a word for the five riders who were in that early break, because I thought they did well, or at least three of them did well, to hang on once they were caught by the Van der Poel Express. They were Jelte Krijnsen of Jayco Alula, Alexis Reynard of Cofidis, Clement Aleno of Burgos. He was the first rider to get dropped before the Van der Poel group came across, quite a long time before, actually. Alexis Brunel of Total Energies was in there as well, and so was Vincent van Hemelen of Flanders Baloise. So the three that stayed with them until the Muir, Krijnsen, Van Hemelen and Reynard, I thought they rode pretty well because they managed to hang on in there for sort of 25 kilometres. And I wondered whether, you know, did that equally suggest that although Van der Poel was going well and Vermeersch was cooperating well and Van Dijk was doing a bit, they were doing just enough, really, weren't they, to keep it away. They didn't stretch it up to sort of 2 minutes. It was still a relatively tenuous lead. I think they didn't get much more than a minute over that chase group, which kept kind of splitting and coming back together again. But as I said, there wasn't kind of the emphasis in the chase, perhaps because so many of the sprinters had had issues and had either been dropped or, as you say, Daniel, punctures for a couple of the key sprinters. So there wasn't quite that level of cooperation or maybe even belief that they would get back on terms with them.
You talk about lack of cooperation, Lionel. Tim van Dijk's lack of cooperation was a bit of a talking point, certainly in the Dutch-speaking media. And there was even a suggestion I saw, I think it was from our colleague Tate Sonneveld, and the Dutch columnist talked about Van der Poel seemed to snub Van Dijk after the finish line because Van Dijk had not worked with him. And it just struck me watching this that there was a lot of talk last year and over the winter as well about anti-Pogacar measures that could be taken and similarly anti-Van der Poel measures that could possibly be taken in the classics. And I think this is a theme we will see this year. It was sort of presented as a bit of a panacea against Pogacar and maybe Van der Poel to not work with them to the extent that people have worked with them in the past. And that was what Red Bull tried. That was what Van Dijk tried. I think that it is a bit of a, it's a false panacea. I don't think that this will work very often. And I think that most of the time when riders and teams try this, they will end up with egg on their face for various reasons this year. I don't know what you guys thought of Van Dijk's approach at the weekend and how well it will work going forward.
I mean, I think he's entitled to try it. I mean, he did go through. He didn't really contribute. I mean, he didn't put his face in the wind enough to ruffle his hair. I know he's wearing a helmet, but you get what I mean. But he's entitled to do that, and especially in a group that size when there's also riders remaining from the break, and they're almost given license to sit on, aren't they? Because they're not going to. They've been out there working all day, and they're not going to contribute to much more because, frankly, they didn't have much more to contribute anyway. They were probably hoping to, if they could get over the Mur, they might have a shot at a top five. As it was, I think it was Alexis Reynard was the best place rider from the break, and he was ninth. So he'll probably have considered that a decent day out from having gone in the early break. But I think Van Dijk, I mean, you're entitled to try, aren't you? It's back to this thing about the peloton being an ecosystem. And if you get a reputation for that kind of riding, things can work against you and everybody starts working against you. But at the end of the day, the likes of Van der Poel, Pogacar, they're so superior in certain circumstances that pretty much anything is fair game tactically. If, you know, he's not required to put, you know, as much work and effort in as Van der Poel is doing.
Yeah, I mean, it worked to the extent that it didn't thwart Van der Poel. It didn't work to the extent where it didn't thwart Van der Poel, but it worked to the extent where he still finished second. And of course, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe are a team that flopped spectacularly in the classics last year. So it was a pretty good start from them.
And for him personally as well, again, there's probably not too much pressure on him to have to work, because he doesn't have any great results. He's got two career wins, one in Romania at the Sibiu Tour, one at the Tour of Croatia. I would argue that a second place at the Omloop Nieuwsblad behind Mathieu van der Poel is the best result of his career. So he didn't come in with that reputation of somebody who, you know, thought and felt he could probably go toe-to-toe to Mathieu van der Poel towards the end. So, as you say, if you do it every week, you're going to get a reputation and it's probably not going to be a very good one. But why not try?
But also, I mean, he had the justification of saying, well, I've got Jordi Meus in the group behind. He's our sprinter.
And Laurens Pithy.
You know, if it all comes back together, it's all going to be cards for him, isn't it? Because he would have been a potential winner of the race. So it wasn't like he was, you know, taking a free ride on the Van der Poel Express. He was, maybe he had a concessions ticket, a discounted ticket on the Van der Poel Express.
Chaps, anything else to pick out in terms of teams, particularly at this time of year, we start to look at, and certainly, well, former incarnations of Sudal Quickstep have been under the microscope in Omloop and on this weekend for sort of how they're shaping up ahead of the classics. But any other conclusions we were able to draw in terms of which teams? Maybe we should postpone this conversation until after we've talked about Kuna, so we can analyse the whole weekend. But anything in particular about how teams rode Omloop? Who looked hot and who was not?
Can I start with not? And the disastrous run's going to continue. Lotto Intermarché haven't won this since 2002, and it will carry on. I mean, for a Belgian team, that's a long, long time since Van Petegem took the win. And I think their best rider was outside the top 20. So actually, just inside the top 20. So not a brilliant performance by them, although I guess we didn't expect them to be really seriously in the mix for the win. But it's been a long, long time, too long for a Belgian team like that not to have won this.
One key move before the Van der Poel move took off was the little foray by Casper Askeen of EF Education around about the time of the Wolvenberg, wasn't it? That solo move, that looked quite promising for a little while. They're a team that haven't yet won a race this season. He's obviously, you know, a very good classics rider. But I suppose what was surprising was that once everyone realised Van der Poel was away, there wasn't much in the way of concerted efforts to try and get a bit of a force together to ride across the gap. No one else thought we could, if we ride up to that group, we might have a shot. It just all sort of sat exactly where they were, which I thought was quite interesting because it was almost like they were resigned to their fate, really. Maybe the bigger teams were thinking, well, we want to protect our slim chances of a sprint victory. Maybe Sudal Quickstep were thinking, well, Manier will get back on and be in contention. But and Visma Lisebike did try, didn't they? But then Matthew Brennan went down in that crash with, what, 20-odd kilometres to go, wasn't it? It was quite close to the finish. So there were sort of mitigating circumstances, perhaps. But it was all a little bit, once the pattern was set by Van der Poel, everyone kind of pretty much sort of took what they had. It was quite a strange race in that sense.
I think there we may already see evidence of another trend that will probably be emphasised again this year, which is the scramble for points. And we know what a premium there is on so one-day races. We talked about that last week, how one-day races, and particularly high-ranked one-day races, is a World Tour race. Of course, they're sort of over-indexed in the way the UCI attributes points, and consequently a sort of sixth place, an eighth place, a 15th place in a race like Omloop is pretty valuable. Incidentally, as I mentioned in the podcast last week, I'll be discussing that today with you. Talks about EF Education Firsts, their Lionel, their direct sportive Tom Southern. I'll be having my heated debate with him later on today, I think. One other thing I was going to mention, UAE, well, their star of the weekend was Florian Vermeersch, really. We talked about the moment where Mathieu van der Poel very sort of matter-of-factly almost rode away from Vermeersch and Van Dijk on the Mur. Vermeersch later revealed that he had mechanical problems at that moment. I don't think it would have made any difference, but he couldn't change. I think he wanted to change down to the small ring, and he couldn't at that point. But he would prove to be UAE's best card, strongest rider again in Kuna on Sunday. Should we move on to talking about Kuna, chaps? Rob, tell us what you saw, what you commentated on.
What did I see? It's funny, actually, trying to remember. A lot of these races sort of pass in a blur when you're live commentating on them. It's more difficult to think about them. But Kuna's always a good race, isn't it? You know, not always ending the way we expect either, but this time it was a sort of a sprint. I think 50 riders got towards the end there, despite a few people trying to thwart it. I think, what did we see? A group of seven up the road originally, a few attacks from the likes of Van Baarle and others, Milan, Binium, who else was distanced? I'll try a few, Dulli, despite his team sort of putting in a big move earlier on one of the climbs just over the hill there in Wallonia. French-speaking side of Belgium. Kuna's a race that sort of crisscrosses a language border, isn't it? We see lots of French names of climbs before we then come back into Flanders. So a lot of the the bigger sprinters had been dropped. Jasper Philipsen, crucially, hadn't been, neither the likes of Tobias Lund or Matthew Brennan, who almost missed a moment, but he was brought back to the peloton by his young Italian teammate, I think it's Matteo, who's riding for Visma for the first time this year. And once he was back on, there was a real element of control towards the end between Visma, Lisa Bike and Dick Athlon, who wanted a sprint. Philipsen only had one teammate with him to look after him, so he didn't have any lead out. And when it came to a sprint, Brennan was just a country mile ahead of everyone else, led out by Christophe Laporte, which of course is going to help, given how good he's starting to look again. Fourth on Saturday in the Omloop, leading out Brennan there. And we talked about Brennan, hadn't we, in the pre-season, the predictions. He'd never won a race in Belgium, but he certainly has now, and he won it very comfortably indeed.
Yeah, it was a hell of a vote of confidence, that, wasn't it, for Laporte to lead out Brennan. Of course, Laporte used to be a lead out man, and then he sort of became something different when he moved to Visma Lisa Bike, where he became a sprinter and a classics rider in his own right. But he spent many years leading out Nasser Bueni, Cofidis. And, well, he sort of put it on a plate for Brennan, but what a sprint it was. It was a very short sprint. I think he dropped him off at about 120 metres. But I don't know about you chaps. I think you mentioned him earlier, Rob, but the overhead shot reminded me of the sort of the best version of Mark Cavendish, sort of circa 2009-2010, Lionel, you mentioned sort of PlayStation cycling. It was a sort of that overhead shot. It was it sort of reminded me of, I don't really play video games, but you know, those sort of video games, whether it was Sonic the Hedgehog or Super Mario, where you used to sort of give the character a turbo boost and he would just sort of streak away from everyone else. And that's kind of what it looked like. Extraordinary sprint.
Very low on the bike as well, wasn't he, at points in as well. And yeah, I've been thinking about Matt Brennan. I mean, Daniel, you tipped him to be a feature of this weekend on last week's episode, didn't you? I think you predicted he would win Omloop. But I mean, these races are sort of interchangeable in a way, aren't they? Kerner, Brussels Kerner, although not the identical same field, it is a second bite of the cherry for a lot of riders. He had a hard crash, as we've mentioned, on Saturday. No sign of any ill effects when it came to sprinting at the finish. And as you say, Laporte with the lead out, and he had his arms in the air very early on, signalling the victory, didn't he? He knew that Brennan had got it ahead of a couple of Tudor Pro Cycling riders. Good day for them after a bit of a shocker the previous day. Obviously, Plumer's, we mentioned, crash, but also Stefan Kung had a very bad crash and serious injury in Omloop on Saturday. But Luca Mazzato and Matteo Trentin, two of their Italian riders, rounded out the podium. But I've been thinking about Brennan and whether he's due a nickname. Born in Darlington, of course, rode for the Stockton Wheelers when he was a youngster. And Darlington, possibly most famous for the fact that the Stockton-Darlington Railway, the locomotion number one, which was designed and built by George and Robert Stevenson, it was the first steam locomotive to haul paying public passengers. Did you know that? In 1825.
Is that Stevenson's rocket?
So maybe, you know, we've got the Paul Sexsass hype train, we've got the Vanderpool Express, maybe Matt Brennan should be the locomotive. The locomotion number one ran to speeds up to 12 miles an hour. I think Matt Brennan's a bit quicker than that. But yeah, a real locomotive performance from him. And I think that sets him up for what we already thought would be quite a big season. He might well nab a very big win at some point, maybe later on this spring. I mean, we saw how impressive he was at Paris-Roubaix on his debut. You know, I mean, he basically rode 230 perfect kilometres. It was just the end bit that perhaps caught him out, maybe ran out of steam. Ho-ho. But we'll see what another year of racing at this level. And what sort of boost to the confidence that victory will give him, because, you know, he's moving his way well up the Visma Lisa Bike pecking order very quickly.
Yeah, it was a performance by Visma Lisa Bike that was reminiscent of their better days of 2 or 3 years ago. I mean, we've talked in the last few weeks about how they've had a slow start to the season, and we even had a conversation a few weeks ago. What prompted that? It was Tim Heemskerk leaving, but this sort of feeling of fin d'époque around Visma, that maybe the era, the kind of short window of time, I suppose, when you analyse it, when they were the dominant team in professional cycling, that's now come to an end. UAE have taken their place. And that, with the announcement as well, they were searching for a new sponsor, that things were not looking particularly rosy for that team. But certainly their performance on Sunday was a pretty dominant one, wasn't it? And it featured very strong performances as well from a couple of new riders, which were surprising additions. Fiorelli certainly was a surprising addition. Came from Bardiani, and he looked pretty comfortable. It was the first time. Rob, was it the first time he was doing those races? It was, wasn't it? Bardiani have never been at Kurna, have they?
Bardiani have been invited on the odd occasion to some of those races in the north, but this will be the first spring, I think, that he's given the opportunity to ride it on a regular basis. And how many times did he come back in that last 20Ks when it looked like he was done? I was really impressed by him and Timo Kielik yesterday.
Indeed. So things looking, well, certainly brighter for them after the weekend, I would suggest. Another team, oh, sorry, Rob, go on.
I was just going to mention a different team there. I don't know if you're going to the same thing.
I was going to mention one team I thought we should definitely talk about, and we'll probably talk about them again in part three, Decathlon, this weekend, because for so many years, the sort of prevailing narrative in professional cycling has been that when riders leave French teams, they become better. And indeed, we talked about Laporte. He was the sort of prime example of that. When he left the French team Cofidis and went to Visma, he seemed to enter a new dimension. The sort of reverse looks as though it's happened this winter. Riders who are not particularly, you know, not particularly vaunted, likes of Case Bol, who, if you talk to Mark Cavendish, has been performing really well for 3 or 4 years now when he was at Astana. But also Andresen, Tobias Lund Andresen, formerly of Picnic Post NL, he seems to have really stepped up as well. And there are other riders. We've seen Dan Hohler as well, riding really well for Little Trek the past 2 or 3 years. But there are a few riders who seem to have been given a bit of a new lease of life by their move to Decathlon. And that was certainly seems to be the case on Sunday, Rob.
They seem to be everywhere. Mm. They seem to be absolutely everywhere. And similar to Visma Liseberg, I guess the last 2 or 3 kilometres when there was that little bit of a panic move there. Well, I say panic from the sprint teams because it had to be repaired rather quickly. For Visma, they had Timo Kielik on the back of Florian Vermeers trying to get away and stop the sprint. So they managed to get with, as we just mentioned, Christophe Laporte helping Brennan back to the front for the sprint. But Decathlon had to make do with a 7th and an 8th for Lund and Bol. Bol really impressed me. He looks reborn, actually. A completely different type of rider, not just a sprinter and lead-out man, but somebody who was versatile, who could climb well. He was following Dan Orla up, as you mentioned, and they looked fantastic. And maybe this is the year. I think I mentioned on commentary yesterday, I was looking down the history, and Decathlon, they've never ever won a monument for all of the years they've existed under Agir d'Azur. So they've certainly got riders that could go up there and threaten this year.
I mean, they did appear to be everywhere, but how much of that is down to the fact that their jersey looks very similar to the Bahrain jersey, and from some angles from the Soudal Quick-Step jersey, the sort of dark blue with the sort of jade green, or in Soudal's case, it's a slightly greener green, isn't it? But also, imagine what kind of factor they'd have been in the race if Thijs Benoot had been part of the team. He's out with a hernia at the moment. And
Olaf Kooi.
And Olaf Kooi, of course, yeah. So, you know, they quietly built quite an impressive-looking team for a lot of races, Decathlon, and it looks like they're racing much more aggressively, and it's a bit like the old cliche, another one, which is success breeds success. When wins start coming, other riders, maybe the pressure's off a bit, and they're able to, think a bit differently, a bit less defensively. Maybe they're not thinking just about, you know, how can we gather as many points as possible. They're also thinking about how can we have an impact on the race.
I think they're thinking much higher than that now. They're thinking that they're a team that wins. I also think there's been a mentality shift. It's very much an international team now. It's a completely different team. Official language of the team has changed to English now when they're at races, Sacre when they're in the team bleu. Bus and things like that. Désolé, I'm sorry, but that's the case.
That's disgraceful. I'm sorry. That's disgraceful.
It is, but they've also got sports directors who don't really speak French now. But if you look at the team, they've got a lot of riders who probably don't speak very good French
cheddar,
either.
Cheddar cheese sandwiches instead of brie baguettes in the Muvet. Cheese and pickle, brilliant. Branston pickle, excellent. Excellent stuff.
You did mention a few of the injuries in there as well. And yes, Benoit's out with after having that back operation. He's recovering. He's going to miss the spring. We also forget that Robert Hayes, who's a really talented rider from the track who for these races would be interested, he's out with a broken collarbone as well. And yesterday it was sort of, even the experienced figures, the likes, you know, we thought we were getting towards the end, especially Oliver Naassen. He looked good yesterday. He was bringing people back later on. Stander Wolof as well, who's always been sort of in and around there in classics teams, had a lot of bad luck with injuries and missed a few springs. He was exceptional as well.
Theirs is a recruitment strategy as well that looks to me to be very coherent, in the sense that we often have the impression, maybe we're doing a disservice to teams in the way they recruit, but they identify individual riders who they think are appealing and they put them together and they hope that the thing is going to gel. And in the case of Decathlon, it looks as though they've really chosen a whole sort of block of particularly rouleurs, particularly riders that are going to work well with Coy and the other sort of sprinters, Anderson as well, the fast riders. And that seems to me to be, well, looks to me to be very smart, particularly for a team whose DNA is very much in their sort of, well, their physical heart or heartland is in the Alps. And the culture of that team has always been one of climbing and climbers. And it has worked at times. Of course, they've had, like, Romain Bardet was their talisman for a long time. But they've really moved away from that with their recruitment this year. But I think that that will serve them pretty well, even when the two blocks get kind of melded together later in the season and the Sexas block comes together with the Classics block. I think that we will see them, well, we'll see more of what we saw at the weekend. I think they are thinking and behaving like a big team already. I know that's long-term ambition, but I think it's already happening.
And with the climbing block, they seem to be getting better and better as well. Think back to what Nicolas Prudhomme did last year. Sort of suddenly came of age at 29. And you've got other riders, young riders, not just about 6S, is it? Léo Bizio, he's really exciting at 21 years of age. You've got Callum Scotson, who was suddenly climbing better than ever last year as well. Several riders who could slot into that. Another of the new signings, probably gone under the radar, Gregor Mühlberger. He's a good one to add into that 6S block. And when you add the rouleurs into it, if they want to put a sort of an all-round Grand Tour team out, it's suddenly a really strong-looking one.
Chaps, I said there was a fairly long list of casualties at the weekend, various crashes. I was just going to mention a few of them. I think we've already touched on Wellens and also Kung, but a few others. Rasmus Pedersen of Decathlon, he crashed at the weekend and could be out for a couple of weeks, I think, at least. Stefan Bissiger of Decathlon as well. He had three crashes over the course of the weekend. Not sure how bad his injuries were. Rick Plomers, we've mentioned him. That was in Omloop and at the weekend. I'm reading here, Rob, three teeth that were
There was certainly some dental surgery. Two or three teeth, dental surgery required straight afterwards. He put a great picture up with the dentist who was into work on a Saturday evening to treat him.
Vlad van Mechelen of Bahrain Victorious, he broke his collarbone. I'm not sure which race that was in. Do either of you know?
That was on Saturday.
That was in. Frederic Frison, he possibly fractured a finger, certainly injured a finger. Arjen Leivens had a commotion cérébrale. That's
concussion.
Concussion. Ben Swift, unfortunately, broke his pelvis as well. So a pretty bruising weekend for various teams, as it always is, unfortunately.
There were a lot of crashes, though, weren't there, over the 2 days? And maybe it's because it's a, you know, best part of a year since we've seen the Spring Classics, but it did surprise me how many crashes there were. And lots of them sort of in the middle of the middle, which just highlights again, I think, the tension, the fact that they're riding so close together, the bikes are so fast, they stop so quickly, you know, lots of little jarring movements in the thick of the action, and those crashes end up being the ones where people... Well, I mean, in the case of Tim Wellens, I mean, that's a disaster for his spring campaign, isn't it? Fractured collarbone, be out for some weeks, probably be back on the turbo, the indoor bike, pretty soon, but I think, is it surgery? He's going to require surgery or not yet?
Yeah.
If it's surgery, then it will be tricky. I mean, it's not impossible to come back for the races in April from here, but it's not easy.
There's already a lot of talk about how that is going to hamper Tadej Pogacar in Milan-San Remo, particularly because...
Well, Jonathan Narváez is out as well, isn't he?
He crashed, of course, in stage four of the Tour Down Under. And those were the two, well, Pogacar's two main men for positioning, certainly going into the Cipressa. So we know that last year that was the centrepiece of his efforts to win that race for the first time. We expect the tactics this year to revolve around something similar, and they're going to have to call in reinforcements, aren't they? I think Vermeers will certainly have a role, whether it's on the Cipressa or before that. And you think of the likes of Jan Christen, who's been riding well. We haven't really seen Jan Christen very prominent in one-day races, certainly not in classics up until now. Isaac del Toro is on great form as well, but he's had his problems going into the Cipressa in the past couple of years. So it's a bit of a puzzle to solve now for UAE, I would imagine.
Positioning is more important, I think, for them than the firepower, because even when they've had the firepower in the last couple of years, it's not been well positioned. As you said, Del Toro's been missing, a few others as well. Maybe that is where Vermeers could help, but then you've got to have the firepower to stay on the wheel behind it. It's not an easy thing, and yeah, to a certain extent, at that point in the race, San Remo's a bit of a lottery anyway, isn't it? So we'll see how that goes.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
This episode is also sponsored by Babbel, a language learning app which can help you become fluent in a new language. Daniel and Rob, of course, are fluent in several languages. I've always been very envious of their linguistic skills, but I've been using Babbel to improve both my comprehension and my speaking. And Babbel really works because you can incorporate it in your daily routine and make real progress with just 10 or 15 minutes of learning every day. So the progress is quick because the lessons are designed by real language experts, and it's a method that's proven to work. You can develop your skills depending on how you learn best, either by listening or speaking, reading or writing. Babbel adapts to your style, and it helps to keep you motivated with personalized learning plans and real-time feedback. Most importantly, it will keep you on the straight and narrow and away from the pronunciation police, because with the voice recognition software, you can practice speaking your chosen language out loud. And that's often the best way to learn. There's a special limited time deal for all of our listeners. Right now, you can get up to 60% off a Babbel subscription at babbel.com/cycle. That's 60% off at babbel.com/cycle. And it's spelled babbel.com/cycle. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Well, chaps, we conclude the last part talking about UAE, talking about Florian Vermeers and the role he might play in Milan-San Remo. Not the best weekend for him, despite his excellent performances in Omloop and Kurna, because, as we found out a few weeks ago, he did that interview with Dani Arribas at the UAE training camp, and he confessed, Lionel, to being a big Newcastle United fan. And they lost at the weekend, didn't they? They lost on Saturday, 3-2.
How disappointing. I quite liked him until that revelation.
How disappointing. how disappointing. Chaps, also on UAE, it would be remiss of me not to mention that in last week's podcast, we briefly covered the most recent revelations about Marc Soler and his father. There's a bit more reporting on that over the weekend. The same website, Spanish website I mentioned last week, Ciclo 21, reported that Marc Soler's father, Jaume, is now appealing his 18-month sanction for association with Pepe Martí. And we speculated, as a lot of people have been speculating recently, what the consequences might be for Marc Soler. The first report seems to suggest that he was also possibly being investigated, and who knows, despite his protestations of innocence, could face some sort of punishment for also associating with Pepe Martí. Well, latest reporting suggests that he's definitely not being investigated. So, according to Ciclo 21, he is in the clear, which, could put that story to bed. Chaps, there was also some racing at the weekend. I'm rubbing my hands because this was what I was most looking forward to at the weekend. You chaps were We're talking about Omloop and Kuna being the main event of the weekend. I was very excited about the Fawn Ardèche Classic and our latest look at Paul Seixas on Saturday on the course where he had a major breakthrough, of course, last year in the European Road Race Championship, the Val d'Enfer climb. Just outside Valence in the Rhône Valley, the Fawn Ardèche Classic takes place on a pretty much identical course, or certainly identical loop, to those European Championships. So we were anxious, impatient, excited about what he was going to do on Saturday. What did he do? Well, he romped away. As I said in the intro today, he sort of decimated the opposition and romped away, won by, what was it, 1 minute 47 seconds, was it? And it was a bloody good field as well. He was dropping the likes of Egan Bernal, Skelmoser, Matteo Jorgensen, most eye-catchingly, as I said in the intro, while he was taking a sip of his energy drink, just riding nonchalantly away from Matteo Jorgensen, and winning by that very large margin. And as you can imagine, chaps, the French were very sort of sober about this. They were not getting too carried away. The L'Equipe the following day, just the front page and the inside spread, pages 2 and 3. I'm going to just read the first couple of lines of their report from our good friend Pierre at L'Equipe. He wrote, "Welcome to a new world. A bow and arrow, a race fist, a thump on the chest to show off his sponsor, and finally both arms in the air. Paul Seixas had time to run through the full repertoire of celebrations before crossing the finish line, a privilege reserved only for the greats. And it is firmly among that elite that the young Frenchman is making his mark early in the season, race after race. The 19-year-old even had time to greet his parents with a kiss on the cheek before heading to the podium." And on and on. Wow. What a performance. What a ride, chaps. Rob, you said you didn't get to see it, did you?
I had a little look afterwards. I mean, after reading all the fanfare, I thought, I have to watch the highlights. And I did watch the highlights. And the way he went away with, 41 kilometres to go solo. I think he rode that climb, the Val d'Enfer, quicker than Pogacar rode it when he went and won the Euros last year. And as you mentioned, just a few of the names he beat. I'll add a couple more. Lenny Martinez, Jan Christen, young Davide Pigantoli as well. Arrieta is another good young top talent in the top 10. It was a who's who of top climbers, really. Really, probably, I mean, we've seen that race going and becoming much more important the last few years. Probably the best lineup, I think, that we've seen in the last years at that race as well. And Seixas, you know, we can have a bit of a laugh at the French newspapers going big on it, but, you know, let's be honest. It was a week after he's taken his first race. He's 19. He's starting to show some characteristics like the likes of Pogacar have shown, you know, riding away millions of kilometres from the finish, winning by a big margin. And crucially, we know how patriotic French supporters are. It was his first win in France as well.
Crucially, not a weekend the Six Nations was on, because I suspect the rugby would have been on the front page had it been on. I don't want to sort of pour cold water on the French excitement here. I mean, certainly a performance to make people sit up and take notice. You know, Pog-esque, wasn't it? And it's not just a time gap over second place Jan Christen, 1:48, as you say, Daniel. It was the gaps further down. I mean, some really high-caliber riders finishing sort of 4 or 5 minutes down. So it was really putting everybody on the back foot a long way out and winning very, very convincingly. And it's these two races, I mean, I was quite interested to know where they've kind of come from, because it's only really in the last 10 years that they've really reached this level. The sponsor, Fawn Environment, is some kind of recycling company in the Ardèche region. Correct me if I'm wrong there, Daniel. And the race started off as a very small one, and then it kind of opened itself up to professionals, became sort of semi-pro towards around about sort of 2010, I guess. And in recent years, the list of winners has been impressive. David Godu, Brandon McNulty, Julian Alaphilippe, Juan Ayuso, Romain Grégoire, and now Seixas. So it's a really good test. a really good indicator of where success is now, and it will do absolutely nothing to dampen the enthusiasm for seeing what he can do in stage races as we head towards the Tour de France, will it?
Well, as I said, fortunately, the French aren't getting too carried away. Marc Madiot said said at the weekend he's the chosen one. Jérôme Pinault, former Quick Step professional who's now a sort of media pundit on RMC Radio, he said he's the third best rider in the world after Pogacar and Van der Poel.
I think the controversy will be when ASO give him the number one dossard for the Tour de France. Pog's got to wear number, you know, I don't know, 165 or something, yeah. And Seksas is given number one.
And demand that Decathlon change their kit to yellow before stage one. Yes, Chavs, and Rob, you talked there about how it was Pogacar. Interestingly, Seksas in his interviews after the finish, he talked about how he just sort of fancied giving that a go. He'd seen, whether it was Van der Poel or more particularly Pogacar over the last few years, turn this into the sort of their trademark, these long range raids, and he hadn't yet done that as a professional, so he thought he'd give it a go. He had exceptional legs, and that is certainly what he did. I mean, it's interesting just sort of stylistically. Obviously there are already comparisons with Pogacar, just thinking of what he's like to become and how he already looks on the bike. He's tall, he's pretty sort of gangly. He doesn't look quite as explosive as Pogacar. The way he was able to ride all of those guys off his wheel at the weekend, well, he literally did ride them off his wheel. Decathlon set a very fast tempo into the Saint-Romain de l'Air, quite a long climb, about a 6 kilometer climb. They set a fast tempo and then he just took it on from the front, and gradually he just sort of blowtorched everyone off his wheel. There was no big Pogacar-esque attack, and the consensus is that he will be more of a climbing specialist and more of a stage race specialist than maybe a rider like Pogacar, who's been able to win a lot of classics as well because he's so explosive. If you look back at Seksas's amateur career, he won in various different ways. Occasionally he would win sprints, but he's not the fastest. He was often beaten by Lorenzo Fin, who was his big rival, the Italian, who hasn't turned professional yet at Red Bull Bora. And the sort of most notable rides that Seksas did as a junior were the big solo raids, like the Classic des Alpes. He once won that by 4 minutes over Pericas, the UAE rider. Just rode away on the Mont du Chat outside. That's outside Aix-les-Bains, isn't it? And so I think on balance, and we'll find this out pretty quickly, he's going to be even more of a sort of Tour de France rider than maybe these first few weeks of the season have suggested. I think he's so strong that he's going to be able to beat people in sprints as well, as we saw in the Algarve. But I think he's a real Tour de France stage race thoroughbred.
I mean, you're criticising the French for getting carried away, but there we are.
Well, we know. I mean, I'm driving the hype train.
I'd love to see that little hat. You got your cheese and pickle sandwiches there in the cab with you for lunchtime.
It's a while since we've had some merch, isn't it? Do we not have to sort of get one of those out? A little train driver's hat for Daniel.
All aboard the Seksas.
The Seksas high train driver.
All aboard the Sexpress. Chaps, just one other thing. Between Kuna and Brennan, of course, Brennan, 20 years of age, he was born a few weeks after this occurred to me earlier, talking about sort of different eras. He was born a month after the controversial Lance Armstrong won, in inverted commas, his last Tour de France. Seksas was born later, of course. Seksas is now 19. But thinking about eras, and it just sort of occurs to me, it's very early in the season, I know, but between Brennan winning in Kuna and Seksas doing what he's done over the last couple of weeks, it feels as though a sort of new world order is emerging to an extent. And the next sort of few years of professional cycling is starting to kind of delineate themselves. I'm sort of thinking back to a moment around about sort of 2019 where we started to talk about these new kind of galacticos, and it really felt as though we could see into the future. We saw what the next few years were going to look like, and maybe we got some of the some of the characters wrong then. You know, we thought, and it probably would have been the case had he not had his terrible crash in 2022. We thought Egan Bernal was going to be one of them, but we certainly thought that the future was going to be Van Aert, it was going to be Van der Poel, Pogacar, Vingegaard, and Bernal, and maybe one or two others. And it just, Remco, and it just strikes me sort of currently, you could sort of look at Brennan Manier. We talked last week about how much he's been winning. Sexas, Van der Poel's going to stick around for a few more years. Pogacar, Remco as well, maybe one or two others. Hector Alvarez was particularly impressive for Little Trek. I thought the weekend, he's still a teenager.
He's still not announced the pro deal either, which is bizarre.
He's not, sorry Rob?
He's still not announced a pro deal yet either.
Oh really?
Surely it's got to be signed by now, but anyway.
Yeah. So he's a name you could throw into the mix, and as I say, well, this is premature and it's not going to pan out in exactly this fashion, and there'll be other names. There might be Finn, there might be Pablo Torres, UAE. But it strikes me that a new world order is sort of being established.
I also think it puts pressure on those riders who are very promising, very talented, but are already 22 or 23. You know, the likes of Lenny Martinez, who was third in both the races in the Ardèche at the weekend, the likes of even sort of Davide Piganzoli, who's 23, Romain Grégoire, who won the Fondrome race on Sunday. He won the Ardèche last year, so he's done the double of those two races. But it does kind of put the pressure on those guys that this next generation is kind of coming up so quickly, and especially Martinez and Grégoire being French and being 22, 23, and kind of the hope and expectation that they may leave a bit of a footprint on the Tour de France. With Sexas coming up behind them, there's going to become a sense of, an imperative to deliver, I suppose. You know, their patience won't last forever, and they may well get overtaken if they're on a slightly slower track than Sexas. If we can stretch these train analogies any further. there's a danger. Some really talented riders might get stuck on the slow line whilst the ones that grab all the wins and all the attention go steaming past them. And that's going to take some careful management, because Groupama have definitely got a good rider there in Romain Grégoire. You know, he had a good season last season, and he does win races. But he's going to be quite quickly in the shadows if he's not careful.
You mentioned Martinez there. It's just 18 months since he was 20, and we were talking about, this is the guy. The French have found the guy, maybe. And suddenly, you know, he's not had a bad start to his professional career. In fact, last year he had a great year. He won a stage at Paris-Nice. He won a stage at the Dauphiné. Here this year he started 3 races. He's not finished outside the top 5 yet, but he's sort of already semi the forgotten man. It's pretty incredible the speed at which this moves.
Mahmoud Diop put the bad juju on him when he left Groupama, I think.
Engineering works on the line.
Chaps, the other name that I've omitted from that new world order is, of course, Isaac Del Toro. He will definitely be a part of whatever happens over the next few years. Well, that all whets our appetite ahead of the clash of the titans, Sexas versus Pogacar. Forget all the rest. Professional cycling can be boiled down to 2 riders, and one of them French, one of them Slovenian. Actually, chaps, I forgot to mention this. Talking about, thinking about anti-Pogacar measures, anti-Van der Poel measures. What did you make of Soudal Quickstep wearing the Slovenian national team kit in pretty much in Omloop on Saturday? I mean, talk about desperate measures to emulate Pogacar. I'm referring to their rain capes, which are in a pretty attractive, pretty fetching shade of lime green, but look very much like the Slovenian national kit on Saturday.
The mind games are just, you know, is that what it is?
There we go. Chaps, the weekend we have got another delicious proposition. That is Strade Bianche, which is happening on Saturday. Of course, Sexas will be there. Pogacar will be making his season's debut. We'll talk in a minute about some of the other contenders. But first of all, we should mention the route, of course, which has been tweaked from last year. Last year was, by general consensus, the hardest edition to date in terms of the number of kilometers on gravel roads and also the climbing involved and also the length of the race. In 2025, indeed, there were 16 gravel sectors. That's down to 14 this year. La Piana and Serra Valle have been taken out, and the Viderata sector has also been shortened. And the race this year will be 201 kilometres instead of 215 last year. I think the consensus is that it has been, well, watered down slightly. Chaps, what do we expect? What should we expect? There are reports that Pogacar is looking rather good in training.
You wouldn't expect otherwise, would you? Rather like Mathieu van der Poel, if he didn't look so good, he probably wouldn't be racing. He's with Del Toro as well, so they've obviously got a strong team. We mentioned that, you know, we didn't know maybe what Wellens was doing, but he's not going to be a factor anyway. Now, obviously, he's off injured. Tom Pidcock will be there. We'll see if Wout van Aert turns up, won't we, as well, after his illness. He was scheduled to go. There certainly won't be a Van der Poel, because he already decided that, well, if Pogacar's going to that race, it's sort of too hard for me nowadays. He's not bothering that. He's going straight to Tirreno Adriatico, we think. Jan Christen should also be on Pogacar's team, so that makes it even more difficult for everyone else. It's difficult to see any other scenario than the scenario, isn't it? But you never know.
The scenario, which is what?
Another Pogacar win.
And success?
Well, the key will be who reacts when Pogacar makes the expected move, won't it? That will be it. The moment. Or whether Pogacar will, you know, play with everyone and not launch the expected move. And that's, you know, he's done, of varying lengths, done the same thing three times, hasn't he? And he's won on all three occasions. It's a question of what he does. You know, would he maybe use Del Toro as a diversionary tactic? That could be interesting. But really, if Pogacar moves, anyone who's hoping to finish on the podium has to respond immediately, I would suggest. So it will be very, very interesting to see whether Sexas's move in France at the weekend was kind of a dry run, to see how it feels, look at the numbers, work out what can be done, work out whether it's feasible to try and match Pogacar if that's what he tries to do. But it's one of those races, isn't it? We could, you know, the one thing Pogacar has had in his favour every time he's ridden and won it is that he's had no bad luck. And it is a race where bad luck can have a significant impact on the outcome. Puncture at the wrong time or a crash or whatever. So it will be interesting to see whether anybody lays it down and tries to get in ahead of Pogacar, or whether everybody just waits to see what he does and responds from that. And I suppose that's the kind of the fault line down which the race will play out. Either they let him take the initiative or they try and put him on the back foot. I don't quite know how they would put him on the back foot unless there's a sort of peloton-wide collaboration.
Yeah, the bad news is that there hasn't been that much in the way he's won his previous victories in Strade Bianche that's been tactical. He's just ridden away from everyone. And with the infamous or famous spot where he does tend to go away, Santa Maria, that is closer now to the finish. So you could even argue that it's going to be easier for him to win than it was previously if he decides to use that tactic again.
Yeah, Monte Santa Maria, I think, is 70 to 80 k's from the finish now, isn't it? Something like that.
is it not gone closer? Is it not 10 kilometer, 15 kilometers closer now? Because it was 81 kilometers.
Yeah, I'm trying to work it out backwards, work it out on the map that I've got in front of me. But it's certainly maybe 70 odd k's from the finish now. I would say it was sort of pushing 80, 90, maybe even towards 100 in the last few years as well. Because you had the descent as well going on to it, didn't you, at the start? And then it sort of goes uphill towards the end. The little loop, Colli Pinzuto and Le Tolfe, is sort of repeated again at the end, isn't it? So a tinkering of the route. The one thing I must remind everyone here is if there is some sort of concerted anti-Pogacar start, unfortunately, due to the organisers not providing us the pictures, we won't see it, because this is one of the races, like on the Newsblad Ancona, where we don't get the images produced from the host broadcasters at the start. So we'll see. Let's hope the race is still going by the time we get the images, because if anyone's thinking super mega long range, then we might not see that.
Well, it's that middle third of the race, isn't it, with the real concentration of both climbs and gravel and gravelly climbs that it's going to all get decided, or it's certainly going to whittle down from that point. It would be good to see a sort of more tactical battle on the run to Siena, a smaller group, and see whether, well, when riders do get to the finish together, they tend to wait to see what gets sorted out on that final climb to the Piazza del Campo, don't they? It is a hard climb, that. But we haven't seen it get to that point very often in the most recent years, have we? What would it be? The year that Pogacar didn't win recently? I can't even remember what happened.
Van der Poel,
maybe? Was that Van der Poel?
Maybe Van der Poel. Yeah. I seem to remember an addition with Bernal being involved on that as well towards the end.
There was the Pidcock win as well, wasn't there? Which there was a bit more nuance to that, certainly.
I was just going to say, it's always a stunning race to watch anyway, even if I know there's some people getting a bit fed up of seeing the same winner every week. I'm not one who subscribes to that. I still think it is spectacular, and it's going to look great, isn't it? Because it's such a beautiful part of the world.
Well, chaps, we shall see. We should probably wind things up there. But also, before we do, mention that Paris-Nice starts the weekend. Some interesting names on the start line there. Foremost among them, I would say Jonas Vingegaard. Of course, Oscar Onley will also be there. It'll be interesting to see how those two measure up. And not quite as mountainous. The Paris-Nice are not quite as hilly as maybe some previous editions, although there is a mountaintop finish at Oran. At the end of stage 7, so that's a week on Saturday, and then we've got Tirreno Adriatico as well starting that week. But we'll be back to discuss both of those next week, I would suggest, chaps. I've got a rush, because I've got my heated debate about UCI points, my lunchtime debate with Tom Southam. I hope that will be posted on our friends' feed some point in the next day or two.
Well, Lionel, yeah, we've got a little mini-series for Friends of the Podcast coming up shortly. Every winter I get emails asking how to go and watch the major one-day classics, any tips and what have you. And while I'm not going to become a sort of travel guide suggesting specific hotels or specific restaurants, I might make the odd restaurant suggestion, to be fair, but because everyone's budget is different, everyone's plans are different, some people want to take bikes, some people won't, but there'll be a little mini series of random tips for those who are hoping to go and watch any of the spring classics from Milan-San Remo to Liège-Bastogne-Liège over the next 6 or so weeks. So that will be released episodically throughout March and into April. So if you're not going this year, maybe this will whet your appetite to go and watch one of the best races in the world next year.
I can already hear the wish you were music. Wish you were here music playing in my ears to, there. Do this,
yeah,
Chalmers.
I'm off to put on my fake tan and get my straw boater out for the you know, the shots of me walking along the beach. Voiceover, you know, across the sort of cutaway images of all my meals.
Fantastic. Actually, on that point, I thought of you, Lionel, yesterday when commentating Kurna Brussel Kurna. And back to a meal we had in Kortrijk once. So I'm sure there'll be many tips like that coming up, and it'll be a great series to listen to.
Well, chaps, we'll be back next week.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freed, and Lionel Burnett.